Good morning. We're delighted to welcome all of you, but we have with us as special guests students from Wayland Academy. Would they please stand? Be seated. Students from Wayland Academy have come to the co-ed for oral argument for many, many years and have participated in this program that we have, Court with Class, cleverly entitled. It's a program run by both the State Bar and the Supreme Court. We invite students from around the state to come and hear oral argument. And then after the second oral argument, participate with an assigned justice for the day to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case that they have heard. You have all received some materials so that you can listen to this case and understand the discussion. And if there's anyone in the room who would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Anyone here need a summary? Fine. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to Justice Crooks' left is Justice Patience Robensack. And you will be meeting with Justice Robensack after this session. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, which is 11AP2698, State versus Brandon H. Bentall. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders. Mr. Sanders.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Michael C. Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin. There are two main issues in this case, and the state asked this court to make two holdings. First, this court should hold that the Court of Appeals erred in remanding this case to the circuit court to exercise its discretion to determine whether to dismiss the refusal charge. The Court of Appeals concluded that Bentall had notice of the 10-day period to request a refusal hearing, and that he failed to timely request the hearing. Under the plain language of the statute, the implied consent law, as explained by this court last June in Village of Elm Grove v. Brefka, the circuit court is required to revoke his operating privilege. It has no discretion to dismiss the refusal. On the second issue, this court should hold that, contrary to its decision in State v. Brooks in 1983, a circuit court does not have discretion to dismiss a refusal, even if the defendant has pled guilty to a drunk driving, unless the prosecutor agrees to dismiss the charges. In Brooks, the court concluded that the court can dismiss if the person has pled guilty, but it did not cite any portion of the implied consent law or explain what inherent authority a court has to just dismiss the charge over the objection of the prosecutor. As this court recognized in Brefka, the implied consent law provides for a mandatory automatic revocation if the person fails to timely request a hearing, or if the person does timely request a hearing, the court holds the hearing and it determines all of the issues for the state. If that happens, if either of those things happen, the court has no choice. It has to revoke. It doesn't have any discretion to dismiss unless the prosecutor asks it to dismiss.
Counsel, then are you saying that if a defendant does not timely file for a hearing, and as a result of not filing within 10 days, is revoked, may a circuit court, with the consent and perhaps with the motion of the prosecution, reopen that revocation judgment and subsequently, with the consent and perhaps with the motion of the prosecution, dismiss it?
It's not entirely clear. I don't think there's anything in the statutes which says, but under 967.055, the prosecutor can move to amend or dismiss a refusal charge. But if the prosecutor does so, it's up to the court to determine whether to dismiss or amend, and the court has to find that it's in the public interest to do so. I'm not 100% sure if after the court has revoked, it can reopen. I assume it probably could if the prosecutor wants it to.
So if the prosecutor wants to enter into a plea deal,
sure.
And as part of the plea deal, you're going to, even though you missed the 10-day deadline, we're going to dismiss it. No problem. Reopen and dismiss it. No problem, as you see with that.
I don't think so. I guess I would question who would argue that the court couldn't do it if the prosecutor wanted to do it.
We wouldn't have case law on that because who would appeal that?
Right,
the defendant's not going to appeal it.
Yes.
And if the state wants it, the state's not
right.
going to appeal it. So as a practical matter, while that may happen,
yeah.
It need not necessarily be blessed by this court because I think that does happen, just so you know. But
I don't think
anyone appealed
that
it because that's
right.
not to anyone's
If the prosecutor is asking the court to do it, and if it helps the defendant, then no one's going to object. The court, if it wants to, I suppose, can.
Now, here the prosecutor did that is requested that the court reopen the judgment?
I think the prosecutor chose not to oppose the motion to vacate.
Okay, let's say the defense attorney went to the district attorney's office and had an argument about the sufficiency of the notice, mm-hmm. and to the district attorney's eye, that argument was valid, really valid.
Sure.
And so even before, without a plea deal, the district attorney agreed that it should be reopened and dismissed, which is what happened here. No plea deal. In fact, they went to trial. Is there anything to preclude the district attorney from making a motion like that or joining in a motion like that, and then based on the joint motion, the court doing what it did here?
I don't think there's any reason that the trial court can't do what it did here. I don't see anything in the statute which actually gives it that authority, but I don't think it's been raised as an issue that the trial court couldn't do that.
In fact, the reason I'm asking these questions is because you prefaced your argument here with emphasizing unless the prosecution agrees. A couple of times you said that, and so that's what caused my subsequent, unless prosecutor agrees.
If I can explain, that's in part because after the state's first brief, in the response brief, opposing counsel said that, or wrote that it appeared that the state was saying that there could not be plea bargains in this type of case. And I tried to answer that in the reply brief. And I just want to be clear that is not what the state's saying.
And in fact, you appear today to be taking the position that There's nothing that you can see that would preclude the very thing that happened here today, even absent, in this case, even absent a plea bargaining.
The thing that happened in the trial court, right, yes. Yes, I don't know of any reason that the trial court couldn't rule on the motion as it did and vacate. It chose to stay the revocation and then see what happened with the rest of the case, I guess.
So why isn't that the status of this case with regard to the refusal? It's been dismissed, hasn't it?
The court did dismiss it on the ground that the defendant did not have notice of the 10-day period. Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals, though, concluded that he did have notice, that there was no problem with that.
Just a small question dealing essentially with the standard of review. The circuit court determined that it was illegible. Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals said that, it's messy. Are those questions a fact?
I think it probably is a question of fact.
And so what's the Court of Appeals opinion didn't have the standard of review with regard to that. What's the standard of review? How should have the Court of Appeals been reviewing the circuit court finding a fact that it was illegible?
It should have reviewed it under the clearly erroneous standard, I think, on that. Yes.
Well, I looked at it. I thought it was messy, not illegible. Well, so I'm just as good at determining that than the trial court.
I think
that's
true.
I don't think there's enough evidence to support illegible. But if it's a finding of fact, it's not supported by the evidence.
Not surprisingly, agree. I think that there's really only one way that this can be read. The court may have made a finding, but it's not right. As the Court of Appeals notes on the same form, it's in the state's blue brief at 108 to 110. The top of it says date of notice, and that's what is hard to read. Two lines down is birth date, and that takes the same form. So assuming that the defendant knows his birth date, he would see that shows 071681. There aren't any slashes. It means 071681, just like this means 111710. On the citation, which is two pages later in the appendix, the officer puts the date on four different times and uses the same form. That it was ruled illegible what the defendant argued was that this could be read as saying 11/7/something. Even if that were right, that would mean that the year was denoted with one number, which doesn't make any sense either.
Either that or makes it illegible.
Do you think the Court of Appeals analysis hinges at all on the fact that he was acquitted of the PAC?
Logically, I think yes, that it does. I don't think it should. I don't think it makes any difference.
Okay. So you would have us, in this case, just analyze the refusal separately from any analysis with respect to the underlying charge.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think that the facts of the case, that he was acquitted with a .23, makes any difference.
What do you think the rationale of that is? Why do you think there are two separate statutes, one for refusal and one for OWI, and why they aren't relying on each other in this area of the law?
Because they're supposed to get to two different things. The two hearings are completely separate. One is supposed to be very quick and easy. It's up front. It takes place first. This is a trial. There are lots of reasons why a person could be acquitted that wouldn't mean that he didn't drive drunk or that he didn't refuse. They treat that on its own because the goal is to get people to take the test. And if you're acquitted later, it won't help you if you didn't take the test. As I stated in the brief, in this case, if he had taken the test, and even if it showed a .223, and at that point, his operating privilege would have been administratively suspended. But then after the acquittal on the drunk driving, the suspension would have been ended, and he would have a clean record. But he chose not to take the test.
Do you think the new U.S. Supreme Court case and the requirement for law enforcement to do more if someone refuses in order to get a blood test or receive the alcohol level of the individual, do you think that has any impact on refusal hearings or this case?
I don't think it does, but I think in the future it's going to mean that it's much more important even to have the person take the test, because if the person doesn't, then the state is either going to have to get a warrant, or if it takes blood, say, under some other circumstance, it's going to be challenged, and the chance of it being suppressed is going to be much higher. So there's a lot of incentive to have a defendant take the test.
The incentive on the state, mm-hmm. Not necessarily on the defendant.
Well, he still has some, because in this case, had he taken the test, he would be done with this case. He would have no suspension, no revocation, no conviction. He's done. Even though he would have blown, say, a .23, he would have been done.
Mr. Sanders, my question is this. As I read your initial brief, you took a much different position in regard to Brooks than you seem to be taking here today. Now, from what you said, it strikes me that that's because of some policy considerations. Tell me what those policy considerations are that cause you to move from what was your initial position in regard to Brooks.
If I can ask, I'm not sure about the change in the state's position in regards to Brooks.
Well, didn't you want us to just get rid of Brooks?
I still do.
Well, it sounded a little different to me when you said, unless the prosecutor has made the motion.
Okay.
That's a change. Tell me what policy is causing you to move from your initial position that we ought to just dump the Brooks case. Reverse it. Get rid of it.
I still want to dump Brooks because Brooks applies when in Brooks, the prosecutor did not want to dismiss. And over his objection, the court said that a trial court has discretion to dismiss over the objection of the prosecutor. And I still want that to no longer be the law because, as far as I can tell, there is no authority for a trial court to dismiss over the objection of the prosecutor.
Well, is there authority for the trial court to dismiss because the prosecutor says it's okay?
Under 967.055, if the prosecutor moves to amend or dismiss a refusal or a drunk driving or any of a number of different OWI-related offenses, the court can dismiss if it finds that it's in the interest of the public in vigorously prosecuting drunk driving cases. And in most cases, I think what will happen and what has happened since Brooks is that when the defendant has both a refusal and a drunk driving, there's a plea bargain. The state agrees to dismiss the refusal if the defendant pleads to the drunk driving. And then what it has to do, I think, according to 967.055, is apply to the court to allow it to dismiss the refusal. And if the court finds that that is in the public interest, then it can do so. But if the prosecutor has not applied to the court to ask it, to dismiss, I don't think the court has any authority under any statute that I've been able to find or under its inherent authority as a court to just do that on its own.
Let me ask you straight out. Aren't you saying basically that there is a public policy reason to encourage pleas of guilty to the OWI charge and to allow for a dismissal of the refusal?
I think there is, but as it says in 967.055, the legislature intends to encourage the vigorous prosecution of offenses in concerning OWI-related offenses. And it says that because of that, there can be a dismissal if the prosecutor wants it and the court agrees and finds that the proposed dismissal is consistent with the public's interest in deterring the operation of motor vehicles by persons who are under the influence. So, yes, if the prosecutor and the court think that in this case it will be a good thing to allow the person to plead guilty, to allow the dismissal of the refusal when the person is pleading guilty to drunk driving, the court can do it. But if the prosecutor hasn't asked it to do it, I don't think that there's any kind of authority to allow the court to do that on its own.
I don't understand how your argument under 967.055 can trump 343.3059, which says you have 10 days from the notice to file a request for hearing on the revocation. If you don't request a hearing, the court must revoke your operating privileges. And now you're saying, okay, he didn't request a hearing in 10 days from the notice, right? And yet the prosecutor can now amend this, and where the court has no competency under our case to do anything, this is your state position, as I understand it, which was affirmed by our court last term. The court must revoke. It doesn't say shall even. It says must revoke your operating privileges. So now the prosecutor can pull the rug out from this statute and say, okay, I'm going to amend it. And that just makes a mockery out of the B case that we had last term that says, hey, the court has no, if you prefer, competency or jurisdiction to act. You didn't file in 10 days. Too bad, so sad, you're out of here.
I have no objection if the court wants to just say that that's the case. I didn't want to make it sound like I was saying that a prosecutor is without discretion to plea bargain.
Well, the prosecutor can plea bargain, but he has to plea bargain within the statutes. The prosecutor can't charge a case that there's no facts supporting, right?
Sure.
Because that, like the penalty in that case. I mean, you can plea bargain, but you got restrictions. And one of the restrictions here is you got to give notice in 10 days. Statutory, no exceptions, no straight literal translation and interpretation, and we did that. So isn't the simplest way in this case is to say, hey, trial court has no jurisdiction anymore. No notice was filed. Period.
In this case, absolutely, because that's what occurred.
That's right.
So he did not ask for the hearing within 10 days, and the court has to revoke, and that's that. In terms of Brooks and its whether that lasts or whether that's overruled, I didn't want to limit the ability of plea bargains. I guess I have no problem backtracking from that and saying if we just follow Brefka, in this case everything's fine, the court has to revoke.
Well, let's see how that would play out.
It's been a while since I've been on the circuit court. The penalties, of course, for refusal are higher than the penalties for the underlying offense, let's say, for OWI first. Let's start with that. Are those penalties usually concurrent?
If the court revokes for both the drunk driving and the refusal, they are concurrent, yes.
Okay. Then it seems to me that if you're going to keep the refusal, which is larger, what's to keep you from rolling the dice on the other? I mean, what I'm looking for is what is an incentive or lack of incentive for plea bargaining, also court efficiency. You already have a larger penalty. It seems to me that giving discretion for plea bargaining might free up the court calendar. We'll dismiss the refusal if you plead to the OWI charge.
I think that is what occurs all the time. But I just don't think that there's any authority for the court to require the prosecutor not to pursue both charges.
Okay, but let's say if the prosecutor wants to engage in the plea bargaining, what's the public policy? Should we be allowing that? Seems to me that maybe you're, and understandably so, riding both horses.
It wasn't intentional, but...
what's the best public policy? To encourage plea bargaining with regard to refusal hearings or to preclude plea bargaining if the 10-day filing hasn't been met?
Well, I think there is a distinction between the 10-day filing period and the other, where in the other, the court has to hold a hearing, and in the 10 days, the court can't hold a hearing. So it changes things. As far as the policy, I guess what I would say is the statute makes it pretty clear, as the court held in Brefka, that it is a mandatory policy. The policy was made by the legislature, and they're saying if there's no... If you miss the 10-day deadline, you're out. You can't extend it. If the prosecutor moved to amend, I think, or to dismiss later, that I can see where that would be troubling. I don't know what authority there actually is. I guess if, like in this case, if the prosecutor simply did not oppose a motion to vacate, I don't know that the prosecutor had to oppose a motion to vacate. So as a policy matter, there are some reasons where it would make sense to dismiss a refusal, and I think that that's why it happens all the time. But there are times when it's not going to make sense.
I think the public policy of the legislature is if you drive, you've consented to take a test. Whether that consent's any good may be a question, which in prior years had been, I thought, settled. Mm-hmm. You agree to take the test. And take a test so that you decrease issues of evidence, right?
Yes.
And the ultimate policy then is that people should not drink and drive, because when you drive with alcohol or a illicit drug or even some drugs that are prescribed, your response pattern is significantly different, and you might injure someone. And to protect the rest of us on the road, of which we are hundreds of thousands, the legislature has prescribed penalties ranging from civil to severe criminal. And the goal is to get you off the road. right?
Absolutely.
And that's how the statute should be interpreted, so that it forces you to either take the test or file your notice and not drive when you are impaired. And what should be done to ensure that so the rest of us are safe? This is a public safety issue. So what's the state's position?
That.
Well, all right. I'll accept that.
I don't think I could say it better. I'm sure I couldn't say it better. And that's why in 967.05 it says that the legislature intends to encourage the vigorous prosecution of OWI-related offenses. The point isn't to make it easy or to give a person incentive to refuse. It's to give them incentive to take the test to help the state find out if the person was driving drunk.
That's right. Then you have a jury trial, and you abide by the jury trial. But
and as I've said a couple of times, if you take the test, even if you're above the .08 limit, if you're acquitted later of the drunk driving, you're free to go.
That's right.
There's no problem. That's why you should take the test.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Ben Dahl, is Attorney Barry S. Cohen. Mr. Cohen?
Chief Justice Abrahamson, Justices, good morning. First, let me say it was an honor to see you all 2 weeks ago in Sheboygan, my home turf. When I got the notice for the oral argument, and it said the oral argument will be conducted at the Sheboygan County Courthouse, I thought that was a good thing, but then I had to read the fine print, and my date was going to be here. But nonetheless, it was great to see you in Sheboygan.
It was in bold.
And legible, I think.
It was legible. It was operator error.
Right.
Let me begin. First, I want to address the issue of the state's position sort of changing because I'm not sure I understood the state's position or what they were arguing here today with regard to whether or not Mr. Benthal should get a refusal hearing. And I want to make it clear that the position that the state took in the trial court and the position that the state took in the Court of Appeals, and I can give you the citations in the record, was that the state agreed to vacate the default conviction and agreed to give him a refusal hearing.
So agreed to what?
The state agreed to vacate the default conviction and agreed to give him a refusal hearing, and the trial court judge did as well. The citations that the court can find, the stipulation, in the state's reply brief in the Court of Appeals at page 6, and I have a brief quote. This is from the state in their reply in the Court of Appeals. Once the issue, and they're referring to the issue of the defective notice given to Mr. Benthal, and I continue the quote. Once the issue was brought to the state's attention, the parties stipulated to reopen the default, which gave Mr. Benthal the opportunity to have each of the issues at a refusal hearing litigated, period. The parties were back in the position that they would have been had Officer Bagnall's penmanship been clear and had Mr. Benthal timely filed a request for a refusal hearing. The other citation to the record that I want the court to be aware of is in the trial court. The state filed a brief in opposition to Mr. Benthal's motion to dismiss the refusal. This is found in the record, document number 9, page 1, and I will quote. The state acknowledged that there were multiple ways to read the officer's handwriting. The state agreed with the defendant to reopen the refusal proceeding, which had been defaulted on by Mr. Bentall, and allow it to remain open so that Mr. Bentall was not penalized for not being able to read the officer's handwriting. This was the proper remedy for the situation that occurred. Mr. Bentall was not further penalized and was allowed to request the refusal hearing.
Counselor, I don't see him taking a different position today. I think what he argued in his brief and what he's argued before us is when it goes back, the circuit court doesn't just have discretion without a request by the prosecutor to simply dismiss it. But at the refusal hearing, your client could still present appropriate reasons why he refused. I mean, sometimes people refuse these things because of a medical reason or a variety of other reasons that case law and other discussions have showed are appropriate. I think what he was arguing today is not that you don't get a refusal hearing, but that when it goes back, you don't just have the circuit court exercising its, quote, discretion, as the Court of Appeals seemed to suggest in its decision, that you go back to hear whether your client's going to put on any reasons why he refused, and the reasons were appropriate under the law. That's what I got from his argument. He isn't like Brooks. He'd like us to say, you know, Brooks either doesn't apply because the statute has changed, or it shouldn't have applied then, or some such thing. But I didn't hear him saying you weren't going to get a hearing.
Well, that's great. Because when I read the state's brief as well, it seemed to me that the state was asking as a remedy that this case should be sent back to the trial court and Mr. Bentall doesn't even get a refusal hearing because he didn't file a request for a refusal hearing within the 10 days. And I want to make it clear that the state never objected in the trial court to the trial court's competency to hold a refusal hearing and give Mr. Bentall his hearing. And if the objection to the competency of the trial court to allow that refusal hearing is not objected to by the state in the trial court, then it is waived. And I cite the Village of Trempolo versus Mikrut, which is cited in the Brefka decision. This is at paragraph 3 in the Mikrut decision. I will quote the one line from that case. A challenge to the circuit court's competency is waived if not raised in the circuit court. So the state can't be making any claim at this point that somehow Mr. Bentall doesn't get his refusal hearing or that the circuit court doesn't have competency to proceed. That should be a done issue.
Well, according to the state's brief, on pages 8 through 18, the state takes the position that the Court of Appeals erred by directing the circuit court to exercise its discretion to determine whether to dismiss refusal charge. The state wants the court, trial court, to be directed to revoke Rendall's operating privilege, citing the case we had, Brefka.
last time.
And that is the position. Now, the state takes a variety of positions here, and that's fine, because it says, hey, you want to read this narrow? This is narrow. You want to read it a little broader and deal with a little broader issue, then you should do this. You want to deal with the broadest issue and revoke Brooks and say, hey, doesn't matter if you're acquitted, doesn't matter if you're guilty. No. State takes a whole variety of position in the alternative, but at least 10 pages say your client gets revoked.
And I'm saying that's a different position than they took in the trial court and a different position than they took in the Court of Appeals. They agreed that Mr. Bentall gets his hearing.
Well, it doesn't matter whether they agreed. If the court has no ability. That's what competence means.
But competency can be waived.
Well, you know what? The problem is there's competency and there's competency. There are some issues that can be forfeited or waived, and the court can handle the case anyway. And then there are certain time limits that if you do not comply with those time limits, you are out of court, and the court has no ability to handle the case. So the question is, what kind of time limit is the 10 days? And I thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I read Brefka to say, you didn't meet 10 days, you're out of here. The court cannot do anything. It doesn't have any authority, because that's what the legislature said. No authority.
I have the answer.
Pardon me?
I have the answer, and it's not difficult.
All right. Tell me. Let me in on the
issue in Brefka was whether the court, whether the trial court had competency to extend time limits. That was never an issue in this case. There was never a request for an extension of time to file a refusal hearing. It was just never an issue. That was the issue in Brefka. But I wasn't part of the Brefka case. But in reading Brefka, the one quote, the one line from that case that I thought was critical was the court's reference to it being this 10-day time limit being central to the statutory scheme, meaning the 10-day time limit to require a request for refusal hearing, that's central to the statutory scheme, and I agree. But equally as central to the statutory scheme is that the driver has to be given proper notice.
Okay.
The easy example to think of is, let's say the officer prepares the notice when a person says, no, I don't want to take the test. Prepares the notice, never gives it to the driver. And the officer acknowledges, I never gave him a copy of the notice. I just filed it with the trial court, with the clerk of courts. So they got their notice. They didn't receive any request for a refusal hearing. And so they go ahead and revoke. Chief Justice, 10 days means 10 days. But equally as central to the refusal scheme is that the person has to receive proper notice. They have to be given a notice that has a clearly written date.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be given the notice the same day as it's dated so that they, in fact, get 10 days to request a hearing, and the officer doesn't hand it to them on the ninth day. The notice has to have the properly written address of the court. This is all required by the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in the trial court, I was arguing to the trial court judge that this is really an issue of jurisdiction. And I don't think it is. And the trial court judge agreed and ended up dismissing the refusal charge ultimately because he said this notice is deficient because it can be read in different ways. And not only is that date important for the driver to know when the deadline is, but to request a hearing. But the date has to be clear to the clerk so that the clerk knows what date, if there's a revocation, the date has to start. Unfortunately, I argued to the trial court, and the trial court judge agreed that this was a lack of jurisdiction when really it's the same thing and for the same reasons that this court decided in Brefka that 10 days is 10 days and it's central just as central is that the person has to get proper notice. And it's a competency issue. If the person doesn't get proper notice, the trial court is not competent to proceed with a revocation.
I agree with you, counsel. So then the issue comes, was the notice good enough here?
Well, counsel for the...
Let me just double back. If the court concludes that the notice was good enough, It was good enough to put your client on notice. It was good enough for the 10 days. All of the other factors and all the other elements were met. Do you lose under Brefka?
Brefka, Chief Justice, Brefka doesn't apply here. If the court determines that notice was properly given, then this case gets remanded to the trial court, and Mr. Bentall will stand in the position as Mr. Brooks, standing before the trial court and saying, just like Mr. Brooks, I could have a refusal hearing, but judge, I'm asking you to dismiss this refusal charge because you have the discretion and here are the reasons. That Mr. Bentall should be in the same position as Mr. Brooks.
Why do you think that the court has discretion when the statute says that if you didn't get the right notice, and that was the case I gave you, you must revoke? Where's the discretion in you must revoke?
The state and the court, the trial court, agreed that Mr. Bentall did not get proper notice. If he doesn't, if the driver doesn't get proper notice, I maintain that the trial court has no competency to proceed with a revocation. Factually, if it's determined, as it was by the Court of Appeals, and that Mr. Bentall got proper notice, then the case goes back to the trial court for the court's determination of the rest of the issues at the refusal hearing. The state agreed to give him his hearing, and they can do that because they can waive the competency objection. And that they did in this case.
That's your position, that it was waivable, that the state waived.
The record is void of any objection to the competency of the court to proceed with the refusal hearing.
So even though there was no notice within the 10 days of objection, the state can authorize, by failing to object, the court to proceed, even though the statute says it must revoke.
Yeah, and they did more than fail to object. They stipulated to reopen the refusal because the district attorney and the judge both agreed this notice is not clear. Chief Justice, in my example, if the person, because what I'm hearing really from your comments here is that if a person didn't get any notice at all, or the person is handed a notice, but the notice date is blank, it sounds like you're saying tough luck.
I'm in total agreement with you. If the notice was not good, the 10 days don't start to run. I don't have any problem with that. You know, how good is another issue. And that's the issue in this case, of how was it good enough. I think that the only point I'm questioning you at, if the notice is valid, does the trial court have any discretion when, within the 10 days, the defendant hasn't done anything?
Well, in Brefka, there was no issue about whether proper notice was given, and the decision is clear.
Right.
In Mr. Bentall's case, there was an issue which the state agreed to and the trial court agreed. This notice is not clear. We're going to at least put you in the position of being able to have your hearing. And so, as Justice Rogensack suggested, at least he should get a hearing, or at least that's our position. At least he gets his hearing. And I'll go further. Mr. Bentall should be in the same position as Mr. Brooks. Mr. Brooks, instead of having a hearing on the refusal charge, which he could have, He asked the court to dismiss in its discretion. Mr. Bentall should be able to ask the court to do the same thing.
Well, I have a problem about Brooks. Have the statutes changed significantly since Brooks? Brooks itself was decided on, what was it, the 79 statutes, and that they had already changed by the time that court had, that case came to our court. They've changed since then, right?
Well, they've changed many times, as this court mm-hmm. knows. But I think if you're suggesting have the statutes changed with regard to the 967055 requirement of the vigorous prosecution of these cases, no, I don't believe that there's been any change with regard to that. I think as a matter of practice, and I know that more than half of this court served on the trial bench, there, in my experience, this is 30 years, there is not a 967055 finding or even application by a prosecutor when they move to dismiss a refusal charge in court, say when the person is pled guilty of the drunk driving or there's a part of a plea agreement. There isn't a 967055 issue on a dismissal of one in a plea to the other. So,
is there any dispute that he was handed this notice of intent to revoke on a date certain?
No. Is there a dispute as to whether he was handed the notice?
Yes.
There is no dispute that he was handed the notice.
And what was the date that he was handed the notice?
The date of his arrest.
Which was what date?
Which was November 17th, 2010.
How do you know that 10 days from the date of this notice is... I'm not understanding why it's not clear. Here's your notice. It's handed to you on today's date. You have 10 days. How does the focus become the little box and how that was filled in? I mean, actual notice was received, undisputedly so, on the date he was arrested. And when you look at the statute and what the requirements are, the requirement is that law enforcement hand them the notice. And on the notice it says you have 10 days from the date of this notice.
That's the answer. It's not 10 days from service of the notice. It's 10 days from the date of the notice. So that's the issue. It's not when he was handed the notice. It's the date on the notice. And
well,
if the date's not clear.
That's what the form says. You look at sub 10, if the court determines the person improperly refused to take a test or the person does not request a hearing within 10 days after the person has been served with the notice of intent to revoke. So, I mean, it's really, the statute says, after you're served with this, you have 10 days. That's what it seems that it says to me, not you.
Sure, but the statute contemplates proper service. In other words, if the officer hands the person, serves them
which he did,
on the ninth
you don't
day.
Dispute that.
If the officer serves them on the ninth day, or if the officer serves them on the 24th day. You know, the issue is
but
not
I mean,
the...
if I got it wrong... tell me, but the facts of this case are, and I think it's, I think that's common procedure, that as you're going through this paperwork, you hand the person the copy of it. Right?
Well, that's the way it's supposed to be, but unfortunately it doesn't always happen that way.
But it is what happened here, right?
Correct.
So it's undisputed that he got this on a particular date, and... the statute says that you have to request a hearing within 10 days of being served.
Well, if the statute is different than what the notice that the driver is given, you know, the notice that Mr. Bentall was given says on its face, you have 10 days from the date of this notice.
Well, I mean, then I see what you're saying. You want it to be confined to the date of the notice as written in a particular box, but...
well,
the date of the notice can be, here's your notice, it's today, you've got 10 days. No?
No, I'm saying that what's critical here is that the line on the notice of intent to revoke that says...
I understand what your argument is. I'm just saying there's no dispute. He was given this on a particular date and told you've got 10 days to file this, right?
Well, he was given the notice on November 17th. There's no dispute of that. There is a dispute as to whether the date on the notice is clear, and there is, and what is clear, though, is that the notice he was handed says it's the date on the notice that starts the 10 days. Whether, you know, if the statute, I'm not
arguing. It doesn't say date
with,
on this notice. It says date of this notice. So, I mean, I hear what your argument is.
Well, the date of the notice and notice date to me up at the top, I mean, that should be the same thing. We're not talking about handing this, you know, to experienced attorneys or legislators we're talking about this is given to ordinary citizens. And, you know, how much can we expect? Now, the Court of Appeals did a great job, as noted by the prosecutor here, of after the fact analyzing the form and saying, well, this meets this. But I'm saying these forms are given to just ordinary citizens. The form says you got 10 days from the date of this notice. One way of reading, in fact, when I say one way of reading that notice, is that it's dated November 7th. And thus the 10 days had already expired, was that when I, and this is in the record, when I handed the notice to the prosecutor for the first time, and I said, just tell me what the date on the notice is. And he said, and it's quoted and it's in the record, November 7th, whoa. And he agreed at that point that this is not, if it says November 7th to the prosecutor, then I think it's expecting a lot that you're going to conclude that the prosecutor got it wrong, the trial judge got it wrong, but the driver, he should have gotten it right.
Is there any dispute of the date of refusal? What was the date of refusal? Because that would be put on here if it's different.
The date of the refusal was November 17th.
Because the box right beneath date of notice says date of refusal is different. And
again,
then it's blank.
The trial court and the prosecutor concluded that it could be read as November 7th. That's why this got, you know, that's why we're here.
So under that theory, he would have had, his 10 days would have started from November 7th? He wasn't
correct.
Even arrested on November 7th.
Well,
it doesn't make sense.
The driver
would be gone by the time he was handed the notice.
If the driver is given a form, the driver has to be able to go by what the form says. The driver doesn't. We can't expect that. The form says you've got 10 days. One way of looking at that date was November 7th. The driver says, well, and the driver was in jail. You know, of course, when he gets the form, and he's handed the form. So, well, I guess my 10 days. Is up, I don't know, and doesn't request a hearing. And the prosecutor and the trial court judge both agreed this wasn't.
I don't get how that possibly makes sense, that he could have the date of refusal could somehow be the 7th when he wasn't arrested on the 7th at all. That was 10 days previous to his arrest. How can that possibly be the date of refusal that would somehow trump the request for a revocation hearing? That makes absolutely no sense to me. I'm working with you. I get the technical argument.
I appreciate that, and I'm not saying that it makes sense, but what it does show is that it can be interpreted that way. Yes, after the fact and examining all of this, one can say, well, that's really not the way that it should be interpreted. But, you know, the clearest evidence I think that we have here is that, and it's in the record, when I showed that document to the prosecutor, now this is a lawyer and a prosecutor, and he said the date was November 7th. He deals with the forms all the time. He agreed at that point, this isn't fair to Bentall to default him.
Okay, so copies are distributed to the court, to DOT, to the person refusing the test, and to the district attorney, right?
Correct.
And what happens as a practical matter? DOT does what?
DOT doesn't do anything. The clerk of courts, they get the notice. They calendar it for 30 days or so. If they don't get, most courts, if they don't receive a request for a hearing, they send the notice of conviction default to the motor vehicle department, and the motor vehicle department revokes.
The clerk does.
Clerk, yes. The clerk does. That's how it happens.
So, okay.
And that's, in fact, what did happen here, and then when we brought it to the court's attention, that was all set aside. And then after the trial, the prosecutor asked the court to schedule the refusal case for a hearing. And we never got, well, we got to the hearing, and the judge granted the motion to dismiss, saying that it's not proper, Mr. Bentall didn't receive proper notice as required by the statute, and therefore the refusal charge was dismissed. So I'm asking you to send this case back. You know, I didn't respond on behalf of Mr. Bentall whether Brooks should be overruled entirely. As you can see from the conclusion in the respondent's brief here, I interpreted the state's argument in their brief as we want to get rid of the court dismissing any refusal charge. And at the very least, we want the court to clarify that you can only dismiss a refusal if you plead guilty. Well, none of that affected Mr. Bentall because he didn't plead guilty. And Mr. Bentall has no interest in what's going to happen with, you know, whether the court in the future takes away the authority to dismiss. So that's why I didn't respond to any of those arguments. That should be clear. But I'm asking that the matter be sent back to the trial court.
What are the implications, if any, if you win this case?
If I win this case, I'm going to interpret win as just sending it back to the trial court. The implications are next to nothing to anybody except Mr. Bentall. There is no other case, and I challenge the case that the state in my brief cite any other case that will be affected by the decision in this case. There is no other case that would be affected. In fact, you know, the state's asking this court to make decisions on issues which are not necessary for the decision and which may never become ripe. If this matter is sent back to the trial court, the judge may not exercise discretion. The judge may decide not to dismiss this, in which case these issues are being decided by this court but would never be ripe. And I urge the court to reconsider and conclude that the petition for review was improvidently granted, and there's no reason to decide any of these issues. My red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Sanders, you have a few minutes in rebuttal.
I guess starting at the end and going backwards, on the challenge to the state to find any case that was like this one, I think what the challenge was to find any case in which a circuit court had exercised its discretion to dismiss a refusal when the defendant had not pled guilty to drunk driving. There are no such cases because the trial court has no such discretion. Brooks can't be read that way. In Brooks, the court said, by my count, 22 times that the ability of a circuit court to dismiss is conditioned on a plea of guilty. So no trial court has ever said, clearly that means exactly the opposite, like the Court of Appeals did here. So that hasn't happened, it shouldn't happen, and it shouldn't have happened in this case, because there is no such discretion. To make the state's what the state is saying clear, the state thinks that when this goes back to the trial court, the court cannot hold a refusal hearing. It has to revoke because he missed the 10-day deadline.
Okay, so you are trying to preclude him,
yes,
from presenting evidence that would otherwise be permissible, but how does that line up with the position that the state took back in the circuit court where they agreed to vacate a judgment that was already in place? How does that fit?
It's not the same, but if I can point out, at the time that the trial court, BREFCA had not come out yet. In the Court of Appeals, BREFCA I don't think had come out yet, but after the Court of Appeals issued its decision in this case, the state moved for reconsideration in light of the Court of Appeals opinion in Perepka, which was very similar to this court's opinion, and which said the trial court cannot hear this. The Court of Appeals denied the motion for reconsideration without any comment. So at the time, it wasn't as clear as it is now. But now, after Perepka, I think it's abundantly clear that the trial court here can't do anything except for revoke his operating privilege because he did not meet the 10-day deadline.
Well, unless we disagree with your reading of Perepka.
Sure. In terms of...
What do you want us to do with Brooks now? What's your position on
it
Brooks?
It should be overruled entirely or at the very least held not to apply under the current law. To be honest, I don't think the law has changed much, but I don't think Brooks was decided properly at the time either. It didn't cite any authority of a trial court to dismiss a refusal without the consent of the prosecutor. It didn't look at the statute in any fashion, and it only said the state doesn't attempt to argue that there is no inherent authority, but it never found that there was inherent authority. And as far as I can tell, there isn't any, and opposing counsel didn't address it. To the best of my knowledge, none of the three general grants of inherent authority apply, and the court has no discretion.
Is your alternative position that if there's a plea of guilty, that Brooks then could stand?
If the not in its current form, which was that the court said the trial court had discretion to dismiss even though the prosecutor didn't want to dismiss. And I don't think that there's – the court cited no authority for the proposition that it could – that a trial court could dismiss under those circumstances, and I don't think that there is any. So I think Brooks is just wrong, and that the court should hold that you look at 967.055, and if the prosecutor wants to dismiss, as happens all the time, and the court agrees, fine, but that it's the prosecutor's role to prosecute. It's not the court's role to tell the prosecutor that it can't prosecute. In terms of the facts of the case and the form, I want to point out that the defendant did not file a cross petition raising any kind of factual issue, and in his brief, there is nothing about that. It seems to have been conceded at this point that the Court of Appeals was right, that this was clear notice. So I don't think there's really any kind of an argument there. One last thing, if I may, if I can say one quick thing.
Go ahead, Mr. Sanders.
As the Court of Appeals points out in its opinion in paragraph 7, when they were going to hold a refusal hearing, Bentall stipulated to each issue that the court could even look at. So even if this were sent back to hold a refusal hearing, he already stipulated. His only argument was he didn't have notice. As the Court of Appeals said, he had notice. So even if the court could get by the implied consent law and hold the hearing, there isn't anything left to do. It would have to revoke because he already said all of the issues are against him. So he didn't really want to have a refusal hearing. What he did was move to dismiss so that the court wouldn't hold it. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Sanders and Mr. Cohen for their arguments today on refusal. We've had other cases on refusal and obviously many on driving while under the influence of intoxicants. And appreciate your arguments and your briefs. And that concludes our hearing on 11AP 2698, State versus Bentall. The court is in recess for lunch, and we'll come back at 1:30 to hear our third case for today. We are in recess.